TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Our Renewable Future, Richard Heinberg, How to Get There from Here. This is the second part of a one-hour speech. Richard Heinberg's books and films on energy and his ongoing collaborations with his colleagues at the Post-Carbon Institute made him an inspiration for the international localization and transition town movements. In part one of this program, he gave an analysis of fossil fuel supply, climate risk, and the real power behind fracking in the U.S. Here now is his three-level plan for the transition to renewable energy. He's touching on food production, transportation, housing, manufacturing, steel and cement construction, mining, the internet, and much more, all in 24 minutes. He calls this the economic transformation for the remainder of our lives. Richard Heinberg.
This energy transition is going to be a big deal. And if we want to accomplish it successfully, it's going to be good for us to think of it in terms of levels of difficulty. I'm not going to call it stages because stages would imply, well, we're going to do stage one, then we're going to finish that and go to stage two and so on. We're actually going to have to start with all of these things at the same time, but it's good to have some sense of the low-hanging fruit, right? What we can do right away that won't take so long. Just about everybody agrees that where we should start with the energy transition is coal. Basically, legislating coal out of existence, replacing all of our coal power plants with solar, wind, geothermal, what have you. That's kind of the no-brainer. Coal, obviously, is the worst climate offender, and we could do this, okay? How about home heating? In this part of the country, most of us are using natural gas. In the eastern part of the U.S., a lot of folks are heating with oil. Obviously, all of that is fossil fuels. How to do it with electricity? Well, electric heaters, the kinds of space heaters most of us are familiar with, are extremely energy inefficient. But there are better options. By the way, the strategy of electrifying more of our energy use has got to be front and center with our overall strategy for the energy transition. Remember, most of our renewable sources of energy produce electricity directly. So we have to take advantage of that bonus that we're getting wherever we possibly can by using energy in the form of electricity, wherever it's possible. So in terms of heating our homes, how about air source heat pumps? They're much more energy efficient than electric space heaters or baseboard heaters or what have you. Millions of these could be put in service across the U.S. Instantly, we could do away with a lot of our reliance on natural gas or oil. Now, obviously, somebody's got to pay for all that. So each household, presumably, would have to pony up a few thousand dollars. We're talking roughly $3,000 or $4,000 to install one of these things. So the energy transition is not going to be free. Same thing with transportation. We could drive electric cars. Electric cars are on the market. But the average person does not buy a new car every year. This is a partial solution, but it's something that is possible. It is gaining momentum. More electric cars are coming on the market every year. But if we get out of our cars and share transportation or walk or ride bicycles, that's immediately cheaper and more efficient, obviously much better. How about cooking? Again, electrify everything we possibly can. How about our food system? Our food system is a huge energy user, and we're going to have to transform our food system in pretty profound ways because Currently, our food system depends a lot on oil for inputs like transporting, you know, fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides to the farm. The fertilizers are mostly made from natural gas. The pesticides and herbicides are mostly made from oil or oil byproducts. So all of that has got to change. Organic agriculture is our option there. So we need basically to transition our whole food system to one that is not dependent on these fossil fuel inputs, and it's also much more localized. So instead of shipping our foods for, you know, average of 1,500 miles, we're growing more of our food locally and reducing processing and packaging, because this is actually a surprisingly large contributor to the energy footprint of our food. Okay, that's the easy stuff. And if we did all of this easy stuff, we could probably reduce our reliance on fossil fuels by, say, let's say roughly 40%. It's really impossible to total it up and get to an exact number, but let's say 40%. So what's in the next swath here of the harder stuff? Well, here we're talking about not just coal, but also natural gas. Now, why is that going to be harder than coal? Because right now we use natural gas peaking plants in order to buffer the intermittency of solar and wind. If suddenly, you know, you don't have the wind power or the solar power, but you have electricity demand, you fire up the natural gas peaking plant. And that's actually going to be a more important strategy as solar and wind make up a larger and larger proportion of our total electricity supply. But if we want to get natural gas out of the picture, because it's still a fossil fuel, what do we do in that case? Well, we're going to need energy storage. Batteries are actually an inherently inefficient way of storing electricity. Now, everyone's gotten excited in the last year or so about the Tesla batteries and some improvements in battery storage efficiency and cost and so on. Yeah, batteries are getting better, but if you look at the theoretical maximum efficiency of chemical storage of electricity, it's still way below other options for energy storage. Our most efficient option from the standpoint of cost is storing electricity in reservoirs. You know, just pump water uphill when you have excess electricity into reservoirs and let it flow back downhill through turbines. But we don't have enough reservoirs. You know, you have to have the right topography in order to make optimum use of that energy storage. So, you know, right now we really don't have the possibility of storing enough energy for long enough to get rid of natural gas. In the transport sector, we talked about electric cars, but cars are inherently energy inefficient. I mean, in most cases with an automobile, you're talking about a couple of tons of metal and glass and plastic and rubber that you have to move around in order to transport one human being, right? That's inherently very inefficient. So there, we have more efficient ways of moving people, like public transportation, but it's going to be more expensive to build a lot of public transit, and it's going to take some time. So that's why this is in the second level of difficulty. We've got to do it and change our habits and our expectations about mobility. But what about all the stuff that we ship around the world? We could add kite sails to container ships, and they do make the ships much more energy efficient, but they don't do away with the need for fuel oil altogether. Okay, so really, if we're going to do away with fuel oil altogether and go to sailing ships, we're really talking about reducing the scale of global trade quite dramatically. That's why this is not in level one. We're starting to get into harder stuff. And how about our buildings? Okay, slapping an air source heat pump onto the side of a building is a good idea, but that's not enough either. We're going to have to redesign and retrofit millions of houses and public spaces across this country to make them much, much more energy efficient. Now, there are ways of doing this. In Germany, there's what's called the passive house movement. And it's actually using technology and principles developed here in the United States back in the 1970s during, you know, the energy crises of many years ago. But basically, this is using daylighting and super insulation and heat sinks and so on to reduce the energy usage in a typical building by about 90 to 95%. So why don't we make all of our building regulations require passive house standards? This is starting to be done in Europe, not so much here in the US so far. There are 20,000 passive house buildings that have been constructed in Germany. Here in the United States, more like 20. So that's level two. And if we do all the stuff in level two, we might be able to get to like 80% reduction in reliance on fossil fuels. So now we're down to the really hard stuff. How about building construction? What do we use for building construction? A lot of steel and concrete. Well, it turns out that steel and concrete are really fossil fuel intensive. Making cement, we do it in giant kilns that are heated to about 1500 degrees centigrade. And we do that with fossil fuels. Now, in principle, it would be possible to produce that kind of industrial high heat using hydrogen or electricity, but it would probably be a lot more expensive, and we would have to completely redesign the process. Nobody's doing that right now. We could be making rubber with tree sap again, rather than using oil for synthetic rubber, but how much tree sap do we have? And, you know, how much would it cost to do that? So we have to look probably at reducing the total material throughput of the economy. You know, the amount of cement and steel and mined materials that we're using. A lot of manufacturing is done with electricity. So that's good. We've already got that electrified. But the materials that we use in manufacturing very often come from mining. And those mined materials are very often shipped very long distances. All of that is dependent on fossil fuels. Now again, we could imagine these giant mining machines running on solar or wind electricity. Probably not with batteries, because batteries just don't have the energy density. But, you know, we could have electric cables running to these machines. It's possible to do. But again, nobody's doing it now, and it's likely to be more expensive, and it will be very difficult to do this on the scale that we're currently doing it. And then what about the materials that we use that are made from fossil fuels? All the petrochemicals and plastics that make their way into, you know, everything from clothing to containers to communications devices. So extracting all of those materials or finding renewable substitutes, we have a lot of work to do. We're talking about a world of smaller scale in terms of production and consumption. Probably more labor in many production processes. We're talking about much more recycled natural materials, reusing and repairing things rather than throwing them away. Essentially, what this looks like is a completely new economic model. Over the last centuries or so, we've gotten used to the economic model called consumerism. And this started back in the 1920s and 30s and 50s, really. We had then the problem of overproduction. With cheap fossil fuels, we could make stuff faster than people were accustomed to buying it. So the solution to that was to talk people into buying more stuff than they thought they needed. So we invented an advertising industry to do that, and consumer credit industry, loaning people money so they could afford to buy stuff that they couldn't buy. We created a consumer economy characterized by planned obsolescence. The whole idea was to get everybody to buy as much stuff as they could. Well, we're moving into something that's almost entirely the opposite, a conserver economy, where the incentive will have to be somehow, one way or another, to get people to reuse, recycle, and remanufacture stuff. Now, how do we do that financially, economically, in terms of jobs and so on? This is to be determined, but it's going to be a big deal. This will be the economic transformation of the remainder of our lifetime. Now, when David Fridley and I looked at the communications sector, we found this is definitely level three. A lot of the assembly processes, again, use electricity, no problem. You can power those with solar, wind, or whatever your source of electricity, no problem. But the high heat processes for producing the materials and the sources of the materials themselves are a big problem. Whereas now we buy a new iPhone every year or 18 months, that's not how it's going to work in the future. If we want to maintain something like an internet and cloud and cell phones and all of this kind of electronic infrastructure, we're going to have to do it in a way that is probably on a smaller scale, that looks a lot more like what the internet looks like in much poorer countries. Imagine getting a smartphone and expecting it to last for 10 or 20 years. That's the future. And then there are some things that just don't work in the renewable future, and aviation is in that category. Yes, we probably could have airplanes that run on sophisticated biofuels or on cryogenic hydrogen, but in the case of hydrogen, it would require a complete redesign of all aircraft. In the case of biofuels, we're talking about fuels that have an inherent high cost from both a dollar and an energy perspective. It will take more energy to produce these fuels than they will give us when we burn them. So we'll be having to subsidize the production of those biofuels from other energy sources, which means they're inherently very expensive. So we could have vestiges of air travel with, you know, helium blimps or, you know, a few airliners running on hydrogen or biofuels, but it's not going to look anything like the aviation industry, commercial aviation industry that we see today. And you can get some idea of where we're headed just in terms of the relative energy efficiency of different transport modes. You know, rail turns out to be very efficient in terms of moving tons per mile. We actually need to rebuild our rail networks in this country and rely much less on trucking. Now, when we get to the point of fully transitioning our food system to where it's entirely localized and organic, if we do this intelligently, there could actually be some side benefits, because it's possible to use permaculture and organic production in ways that build topsoil. Now, we've been mining topsoil using industrial agriculture, and that's actually been a very large net contributor to greenhouse gases. But if we begin building topsoil, what we're doing in the process is actually capturing and storing carbon from the atmosphere back into the soil. And so there could be a net benefit from a climate standpoint to this energy transition. And at the end of the day, when we've finished doing the level three really hard stuff, we could be in a situation where not only are we no longer adding CO2 to the atmosphere, but we're actually reducing the carbon load. Now, how much energy are we likely to have at the end of this process? That's an unknown. Again, there are too many variables, but most of the variables that David and I have looked at are ones that seem to militate in the direction of less usable energy. The question that a lot of people are asking is, could renewable energy enable us to maintain our current lifestyle? Well, as the Global Footprint Network has documented, our current lifestyle entails using the world's resources at about four times the sustainable rate. I'm talking about how we live in North America. So asking if we can maintain the North American lifestyle with renewable energy is basically asking, can we use renewable energy to continue living unsustainably? And the answer to that question is, well, not for very long. So we should be aiming for a much lower energy consumption level anyway. And if we aim for a lower level, we're much more likely to be able to meet that level of demand with intermittent sources like solar and wind that are backed up by other renewable sources like hydropower, geothermal, and the rest, which can be used as baseload, right? If we're demanding current level of energy consumption, then we create all kinds of engineering problems in terms of buffering that intermittency with storage and grid upgrades and source redundancy and so on. But you can get rid of most of those engineering nightmares just by reducing energy demand pretty dramatically, like 70 to 90%. Because then you can rely on these other sources, again, like hydro, geothermal, and so on, for baseload, and then use solar and wind for electricity that you can use when it's available. And you can schedule and time your energy consumption according to electricity availability. So that's the cheapest way of engineering the energy transition. So this is what our energy future is likely to look like. Less overall energy. Much of it will be less controllable. We will be less mobile altogether. We're not going to have aviation, and other forms of mobility will be constrained. And therefore, our economies are going to have to be much more localized. Altogether, we're not talking about a plug-and-play transition where we unplug the coal power plant, plug in a solar panel, and continue living exactly the way we're accustomed to. We're talking about a civilization reboot. As we do this, we're going to have to think about energy equity also, because all of this is going to cost a lot. So how do we pursue it? Do we just let those folks who can afford to have solar panels and wind turbines install their own energy systems, and the rest of us just rely on what we can still afford until it runs out or it's no longer available? That's one possible pathway to a renewable energy future. It will be an extremely dysfunctional pathway because all it will do is exacerbate the already extreme economic inequality that we see in this country and around the world. So if we don't want that future, we're going to have to plan for energy equity. And that's another whole lecture. So the opportunities here are sizable. We could have a much more energy-efficient economy. We could have, in fact, a more acceptable quality of life, even with much lower energy consumption per capita, if we plan for the transition and make it in a coordinated way. Obviously, we'll have a much more stable climate if we do this. Obviously, we'll have greatly reduced health and environmental impacts and costs. and we will be able to remove carbon from the atmosphere. But it's going to require a lot of investment. That means we have to make this a top priority as a society. It will require regulation. I said earlier, we have to basically regulate coal out of existence, and then do that also with oil and natural gas. And we can't do that until we have alternatives ready to go. We're going to have to change behaviors and expectations, and it's going to ultimately give us an economy that looks very different from the consumer economy of the 20th century. So it's a big job. And right now, we don't have folks at the national political level talking very much about it. In fact, we have one whole party that denies that this is even a possibility or a necessity. So we have a lot of work on our hands. And where we can do this work on the local level, we can get started. And therefore, our economies are going to have to be much more localized. This is going to be a difficult, expensive, and long process. We can't do it all in 5 or 10 years, but we have to get started, and the longer we wait, the more difficult and expensive the process, and the more likely we will end up at the end of the day with a political and economic system that's much less functional than it would otherwise be.
That was Richard Heinberg. He's senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute and has written extensively on energy and ecological issues. Even his first book, The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies, caught the attention and imagination of many. He has been quoted and interviewed by Reuters, AP, and Time magazine, and on TV in the US, Canada, Australia, and by Al Jazeera. Heinberg has also appeared in many films and TV documentaries, including Leonardo DiCaprio's 11th Hour. His animations, Don't Worry, Drive On, Who Killed Economic Growth, and 300 Years of Fossil Fuels in 300 Minutes, have been viewed by more than 1.6 million people on YouTube. He was recorded and filmed by TUC Radio at the Little Lake Grange in the small former logging town of Willits, California, on November 15, 2015. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.